Okay?
Okay, better. So again, tonight's shiur is sponsored by Chana Spivak in loving memory of her son, Benjamin Ben Yomin Eliezer Ben David V'Chana, on his ninth yahrzeit, Chav Gimel Elul. May his neshama have an aliyah. Believe it or not, this first lecture was not recorded. The second lecture, we had a gentleman volunteer to record it, and it was recorded, last week's lecture. This week's lecture is also being videoed at this moment by magic. All right, there are magical things in the ceiling, and they go on at 8 o'clock, and they go off at 9:10. And the person who's operating them is many, many miles from here. And that's how it works. How we live in a high-tech society. We'll see how it turns out. All right. Tonight, we're going to be speaking about Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, whose real surname was Pupko. For some reason, somewhere along the line, it was changed to Kagan, which is a way of saying Kahan or Cohen, because he was a Kohen. But he's known to the world for his major work, a copy of which I have here, called Chofetz Chaim. Mihu Isha Chofetz Chaim, who's the person who desires life, we're told in Tehillim. Mitzor Lashon Chomeiro, guard your tongue from evil. Svasecha Midaber Mirmo, make sure you don't speak falsely, improperly. This was his a dominant theme in his teachings and his writings. There's a lot to say about his biography. What's interesting is that we've had three very diverse people that we've spoken about, one of whom, the first one, the Pshischa, the Simcha Bunim of Pshischa, left nothing in writing, absolutely nothing. Everything we know about him is hearsay, reports, stories, and anecdotes. Last week we spoke to Maharal, but the Maharal wrote prolifically. He wrote, mentioned that the Machon Yerushalayim edition of his works, which is heavily footnoted, has already somewhere about 25 or 30 volumes. Chofetz Chaim, too, wrote voluminously. He wrote throughout his life. A good part of his life, he supported himself by selling his books. Let me tell you, you don't get rich by selling Jewish books, even if they're at the level of the Chofetz Chaim. And he lived a very, very long life. We know for sure when he was born. He was born in 1839, and he died in 1933, so figure it out, it was 94. 95 years when he passed away. Today, Tuesday, Chof Zalad Elul was his yard site. There's much to be said about him. However, it kind of disturbs me personally. Most of what you will hear about the Chofetz Chaim is stories about him which may or may not be true. They're stories. And yet we have so much that he wrote in writing. Why do people insist on telling stories about the Chofetz Chaim when they could quote his teachings from his vast writings? And I always insist that when you're going to talk about the Chofetz Chaim, don't just tell stories. Many of the stories that are told about the Chofetz Chaim were told 200 years ago before the Chofetz Chaim were born about other great tzaddikim. But the other great tzaddikim, for whatever reasons, were forgotten, but a few stories about them were told, and they're kind of pinned on to the Chofetz Chaim, because if you can tell a story about a great tzaddik, so who was a great tzaddik, indisputably a great tzaddik, was the Chofetz Chaim. Nevertheless, I'll begin by telling a few stories about the Chofetz Chaim. So the first story I'll tell about the Chofetz Chaim, I heard from my Zaydi, from a Chaim Yitzchak Weinreb, my father's father, who was privileged to see the Chofetz Chaim and to hear him. And the story he told was this. The Chofetz Chaim was passing, my grandfather left Europe in the early 1920s. But before that, he lived in Galicia, and he lived in a place between Shemesh and, I mentioned the other time, between Shemesh and Lemberg. And in Lemberg, or Lvov, it goes by different names depending upon who occupied it. The Jews usually call it Lemberg. It was a big town in Galicia, and the Chofetz Chaim was passing through the town. This must have been somewhere around 1909 or 1910. And what happened was that people heard that the Chofetz Chaim is passing through on a train. The train's going to be stopping for a stopover in Lemberg, And everyone in the city is going to go to greet the Chafetz Chaim and maybe hear a few words from him. So my grandfather told me that he was a young man, and he probably much more than a boy, and he went with everybody else. But people were pushing, and of course the older people got priorities. My grandfather used to say, it's not like nowadays. In those days, the old people went first, and we young ones stayed back. But he did manage to hear the Chafetz Chaim say a few things. And one of the things the Chafetz Chaim said was that when you pray or make a brocha or a bench, or birchas hamazon or whatever, always pray from a text, from a siddur or a benchroll or a machzah. Don't pray by heart, even if you know it by heart. Pray from, in Yiddish, from inner veinig, from inside the text. My grandfather had a hakpada, which he kept all of his life, of always reciting every bracha, shahakol niyeh b'dvoro, on a cup of tea. He would take out a little benchidol that he had with him and recite it from the bracha. Even Asha Yotza, when he came out of the restroom, he would say the Asha Yotza, he would take out a little benchidol and say it from the text. He told me to follow that practice too, which is one of the many things that I didn't follow my grandfather's ways. But I tried to some extent to do it. But that's an interesting story that I heard firsthand from someone who saw him. There were several men in Baltimore who were Talmidim of the Chafetz Chaim, and probably were the last living Talmidim of him. Each of them passed away, Rabbi Borowski and Rabbi other Rabbonim in Baltimore, whom I heard various stories and Divrei Torah from him, from them, for about the Chafetz Chaim. But the story about the stories is a famous one. And this story may also not be true, but it says a lot. There was once a person who was accused of some terrible crime by the Polish government or Russian government. Radin sometimes was in Poland, sometimes in Russia, depending upon the world's politics. But he was arrested. So the lawyers were desperately trying to find character witnesses who could say that this person was a legitimate fellow, an honest fellow. He wouldn't have done the crime that he was accused of. So they either put the Chafetz Chaim on the witness stand, or he wrote a document, a letter to the court. And the lawyer read the letter to the court. And the lawyer said, you know, honored the judge, I want you to know that the man who is testifying here as a character witness on behalf of this accused fellow, he's a very special saintly man, and he's a kind of a person that some years ago there was a thief broke into his home and stole whatever there was to take, a few silver menorah, becha, whatever it was. And then he heard someone stirring, and he ran away. Chafetz Chaim came out of his bedroom or whatever, and saw that some things were missing. He realized the thief had broken in. So, but he saw the thief took the menorah and he took the becher, but he left behind the candlesticks that his wife had, silver candlesticks that's used to bench left with on Shabbos. So he took the candlesticks and ran after the thief and said, you forgot something. So this is the story. So the judge, so this man is the one who's testifying on behalf of the accused. This man, a saintly man, you have to consider what he's saying. So the judge looked at the lawyer and said, do you expect me to believe that story? So the lawyer said, look, Your Honor, I don't know whether it's true or not. You want to believe it, you don't want to believe it. But one thing, Your Honor, they don't tell such stories about you and me. Right? So that's kind of tells a lot about all the stories you hear about the Chafetz Chaim. They may be true, they may not be true, but you can be sure they don't tell those stories about you and me. They tell them only about the Chafetz Chaim, which says who he was. There's an interesting, a very tragic fact that many people are not familiar with. There was, I'm sure you've heard the name, Eitan Henkin. He and his wife were killed by terrorists, must be now about 4 years ago. Hashem Yinkom Damav. So he was a tremendous Talmid Chacham, and he wrote many articles, etc. But at one point in his tragically young life, I think he was in his early 30s when he was killed, he entered the university, and under university supervision, he went for a doctorate in Jewish history. And the subject of his thesis was going to be the Chofetz Chaim. He was going to write, because since most of what we have about the Chofetz Chaim are stories, anecdotes, let me look into the primary resources, into archives, letters, people who saw him and knew him. There were biographies written about him in his lifetime, including a biography that his own son wrote about him. So I'm going to go research and write a scholarly biography, a biography that meets secular academic standards about the Chofetz Chaim. It would be a tremendous, tremendous contribution to understanding the story about this great person. So he accumulated a lot of material, and then he was killed. And his professor, chairman of his dissertation committee, was a professor named David Asaf, who was a professor, who wrote a hespit about Eitam Henkin soon after he was killed, and wrote what a great loss this will be, because we have some of the material that he accumulated, but to put it together and to write it up properly is a gift that only this Eitam Henkin had. But the professor, his name was David Asaf, he allowed several of us, myself included, to look at the raw files that he had. So he sent me a PDF with some of the raw files. So he has a letter that the Chofetz Chaim wrote to a distant relative of his, a second or third cousin, a woman who had gone to America long before he wrote the letter. He wrote the letter soon after the World War I, so like 1918, to this woman living in somewhere in Ohio. Not Pittsburgh, and that's Pennsylvania, not Cleveland, and not Cincinnati. What's the Canton, Ohio. C-O-N-T-O-N, Ohio. And he wrote a letter to her, and he said to her, you know, you write me letters in which you tell me what you're reading in the newspapers. I don't read newspapers, and it's not because of my piety that I don't read newspapers. I don't read newspapers because most of what you read is not true. He already knew about fake news long before our current president of the United States. Most of it's not true. Most of it is bad news. Almost all of it is bad news. You hardly ever read good news in the newspaper. And there's really nothing you can do about anything in the news. So why bother reading the news? Very practical suggestion. And this is actually a document. This is not a story. This is written in his hand to a distant relative in Canton, Ohio, off the Jewish map. During his lifetime, he married twice. His first wife died young. And I know several people who are descendants of the second wife, including a man named Baltimoreans here tonight. I don't see any. Okay. Shmuel Tarshish, who was very active in Shom Emuna, my former shul, is a great-grandson of the Chofetz Chaim through the second wife. But also great-grandchildren who recently passed away was Rabbi Hillel Sachs, the son of Rabbi Mendel Sachs, who was a big gaon of Rosh Hashiva here in Israel, who was a grandson through the children of the first wife. In any case, the Chofetz Chaim started, for a time he tried to run a grocery store and make a living that way in a town called Radin in Poland. Or again, Poland or Lithuania or Byelorussia, depending upon where, White Russia, depending upon when. And eventually his wife ran the grocery store. The grocery store failed. He opened the yeshiva in Radin, which was in existence until the Holocaust. I knew several people who studied there, really briefly. And he was one of the main people active in the founding of the Agudas Yisroel. Very recently, within the past year, they discovered some film footage of that first or second Knessia Gedola of the Agudas Yisroel in Vienna or wherever it was. And lo and behold, in the middle of that footage, they see an image of the Chofetz Chaim being ushered from the hall to the train or whatever. So you see a picture of this very short, humble-looking man being treated with all this kavod. Walking for a few moments, you see an actual film of him. This is fascinating. Chofetz Chaim was a big Ohev Tzion and very much supported the movement of Jews to Eretz Yisrael. He himself wanted to go to Eretz Yisrael and made plans to do so in the 1920s, but the Rabbonim of his time gathered together and met with him and pleaded with him not to go. We need you here in Eastern Europe. And he never came to Eretz Yisrael. He actually had purchased or arranged to purchase an apartment or something in Petach Tikva. The Chofetz Chaim has a lot to teach us in many, many ways. What I'd like to begin with in the themes is to look at some of his practical suggestions. Because often we think of a great tzaddik and a great Talmud Chacham like him as being a little otherworldly, as being somewhat of a Luftmensch, you know, head in the clouds, not really down to earth and practical. But there are many things that he taught that was very, very practical, and I'd like to share them with you, including one or two that are actually written and written in your source material. The source material appears on both sides of the pages, not the first page, but the other pages. But before we get to the actual source material, there were two pieces of advice that he gives in footnotes to one of his sforim. The sefer is called Ahavas Chesed, the sefer in which he writes about the importance of doing chesed, of doing good things for other people. So in his footnotes are really a place to look, because his footnotes are almost always digressions from the main text. So the text dealing with the importance of doing chesed, the footnotes can go off in all sorts of directions. So one footnote is something which was first pointed out to me by Rabbi Heinemann of Baltimore, should be well, with whom I occasionally served as a part of a Beis Din. And he pointed out to us, especially us who were, three of us were much less experienced than him with the Batei Din, and he said, usually when two Jews come to you to a Beis Din and they have a disagreement, the disagreement is because when they made the original agreement, they didn't spell out specifically what their expectations were of each other. I mean, we had a case, and this is the case at which Rav Heinemann had showed us this remark from the Chofetz Chaim. A person hired a contractor to do some repairs, painting, shiputzim, in their home. And they came into the finished product, and they saw, oy vey, he painted the living room white and the kitchen gray. And they wanted the living room gray and the kitchen white. So the contractor said, you know, look at the original contract, you know. You told me off-white and cream white, all right? So off-white is gray, and cream white is what we did. And they said, it's not cream white, it's yellow. And they said, it's not off-white, it's gray, it's black, it's a dark gray, whatever. Had they originally spelled out, which is very easy to do, you take a sample, a swatch of the color that you want, and you staple that onto the original agreement, and you know, this color white, and then they take it to the wall. If it matches, fine. If it doesn't match, you don't pay. But because they left things undefined, that's what caused the great disagreement, and you can never resolve it. What are we supposed to do? We're sitting in a case listening to what he says, it was off-white. It's impossible to resolve this kind of situation. So the Chofetz Chaim writes, and his experience, all disagreements in life, I'm paraphrasing what he wrote, all disagreements in life between people come because of poorly defined expectations. He says, he writes, this is true in Dine Torah, you know, when you have the contractor and the house owner, but it's also true in marriages. You have disagreements because when the boy and girl were dating, they didn't make clear, you know, exactly who was going to support them, you know. So he thought it was going to be her father, and she thought it was going to be his father, and meanwhile, it's neither father, except for the Father in heaven, and this causes great difficulties. And in all relationships, this is true. You have to define your expectations. And he writes, the more effort you put into the original shtar, the original contract, the less disagreement you have, the less machlokas you have. It's a practical piece of advice. Another practical piece of advice that he has in the footnote to the Sefer is, and this really relates to tshuva, to practical tshuva. He said, the problem is that most of us, when we make a vow, most of us, he's speaking to people who read his Sefer, when we speak about how much Torah we're going to learn next year, so we say, oh, I'm going to learn 100 blot. I'm going to learn Daf Yomi every morning. And then we sit down and we get overwhelmed because I'm supposed to learn so much and all I accomplished today was a few lines, etc. He said, no, you should always think of it. And he writes, Hayom Hazeh V'Hadaf Hazeh. All right, today I'm learning this page today. This is what I'm doing today. Focus on one piece that you're doing today, whatever it is, one line, one pasuk and chumash, whatever it is. Focus on what's in front of you. Focus on the here and now, and don't get stuck with all your ambitions, which may or not ever come true. Narrow down your expectations and focus on this day and this page. Chafetz Chaim also was a very big proponent of people writing or composing their own prayers, their own tefillos. He writes in a beautiful passage that I didn't reproduce for you. He writes a beautiful passage which he said, I think it's very demanding. It's not enough to daven three times a day. Why? Because the three times a day, we do it by habit, we do it by routine, we don't have kavana, we say it by heart, we're distracted. It's also important to pray every day your own prayer, in your own words, in whatever language, because that's one's going to be sincere. You're going to really mean it. You can cry a little bit, you know, he says, pray with tears, and have your own prayer. It's interesting, it's a personal reflection, because I've often quoted this Chafetz Chaim, and I've been criticized. Chafetz Chaim couldn't have said that. Because there are various sources which say that one should that can be interpreted as saying one should not make up their own prayers. But I feel that those sources, written by holy, wonderful people, they're there because they want to emphasize the importance of the written prayer. You will hear people who will say, what am I going to pray these ancient prayers for? I can go to God, say, God, please help me, and that's enough. You know? So against that, we say, no, you have to pray. Pray what's written in the Siddur. The Chafetz Chaim wasn't against praying what's in the Siddur, but he was saying there's room for a person's own spontaneous, authentic, heartfelt prayers. I had the experience, the Steingedacht, when the three boys were kidnapped and murdered so brutally here a couple of years ago, already 3 or 4 years ago. So I was sent by the OU to be Menachem Oval, the families. I came from the United States, and I came here and spent a few days, and that's a story in itself, many stories. But when I came back to the States, the OU asked me to go around to try to answer for various audiences the question that was in everyone's mind. I'm sure it's true in Eretz Yisrael, but it was true in America too. Every shul, every person, left to right, was praying for the well-being of these boys. And it turned out that they were dead the first day that they were kidnapped. So here we were praying for about 3 weeks, 18 days, I think it was. Everyone's praying, saying Tehillim and everything else. Were our prayers in vain? Were our prayers in vain? So they asked me to address this topic, which is a difficult topic. But I spoke once somewhere outside of New York City, and I mentioned the importance of spontaneous prayers. And I quoted this passage from the Chafetz Chaim. And in the group, there were young women who were students of a certain campus, college campus, Kiruv program. And they said to me, you know, they were in shock because I was encouraging people. I said the Chafetz Chaim, whom they never had heard of. Usually if you quote the Chafetz Chaim, that's it, you know, he's the authority. But they didn't hear of him, and they said they never knew that it was permissible to compose your own prayers, because we've been praying all our lives. Now we came into these lectures on Tshuva, and we're told, no, you have to pray from the city. You can't pray your own prayers. So how do we do that? So I met with the person who runs this Kiruv program. We decided to have a debate. All right, we actually debated this, where he insisted we couldn't encourage people to compose their own prayers. What can I say, whether it's my opinion, the other guy's opinion, the Chafetz Chaim writes, you should compose your own prayers. And he says to do it every day. He also has an interesting sefer. This is relatively unknown compared to his other sforim. It's called Machane Yisrael, the Camp of Israel, which is used, I'm told, by friends of mine who are either were in the army or are in the chaplaincy in the Israeli army, that this is a sefer that I find very helpful with the IDF, with the Israeli Defense Forces as well. Chafetz Chaim didn't write it for the IDF. Chafetz Chaim wrote it for soldiers who were conscripted into the Russian army, into the Tsar's army, which is very different from the Israeli army in many ways. But so he has this soldier who writes to him and says, you know, I can't pray because I have no time. I'm always on guard, and every moment I'm under watch. And if they see me praying, especially if I put on talus and tefillin, you know, it's all over. They're going to throw me in a dungeon or somewhere. And so Chafetz Chaim says, do you have some moment when you're on guard duty and no one else is around you? So he says, yes, but if I'm caught praying, so the Chafetz Chaim said, all you have to do is say one pasuk, any pasuk you want to say. Yechid chose the pasuk, Korov Hashem l'chol korov l'chol asher yikruhu v'yemes from Ashrei. God is close to all who call upon him, as long as you call upon him sincerely in truth. Just say that pasuk. But do you have a compass? So the soldier says, of course I have a compass. Every soldier has a compass. They have to know which direction is which. He says, with your compass, figure out from where you're standing in a Siberia, wherever you are, what's the direction toward Yerushalayim. And say this one pasuk while you're facing Yerushalayim, and that's all you have to do. And this was the practical advice that the Chafetz Chaim wrote to this soldier. There's another practical advice which he actually wrote in Bir Halacha. You could turn to the page with the number one circled in the first source sheet. You see a very, very interesting thing. It's in Rashi's script, and it's very small. It's in the Mishnah Berurah. If you want to look it up afterwards, in Simon Resh Mem Vav, in the Bir Halacha, with the paragraph beginning, Rak Sheyisparsem, at the end of it. Now, this is very interesting. The passage occurs in a description of several simonim, several chapters in the Shulchan Aruch, which deal with a very thorny issue, which is quite common, but very difficult halachically, and that is, what do you do if you're a partner with a non-Jew, and the partnership has to endure over Shabbos? You own a hotel together with a Gentile, and the hotel is open and doing Chilul Shabbos, or you have a factory, or you have a farm, you know, and you're jointly owned by a non-Jew and a Jew, and there's work being done on Shabbos. How do you arrange for this? So there are various arrangements that can be made, complicated arrangements. There are those who are more lenient about certain practices, those who are more strict, and the Shulchan Aruch goes through all sorts of scenarios about how it can be arranged and how it can't be arranged. So I know someone very well who is in business, and there was going to be an arrangement where they would be in the business with a non-Jew. And it was a retail business, wholesale business, it doesn't matter. And so this person went to a Rav, a very chashuv Rav, and asked him, you know, how can we arrange, according to the halacha, a way to do this? So the Chafetz Chaim treats this in his Sefer Mishneh Berurah. He treats all the pros and cons and ins and outs and, quote, loopholes and things which you can do, and the strict opinions, lenient opinions, etc. But then, if you look at this little thing, if you can see it in small letters in Rashi's script, he writes, and this is the end of his whole discussion. This goes on for pages, but this is the bottom line. It begins with the Havi Aram, etc. Then, Vav Ayin Chof, that's the Alkain, Ein Lahokel B'inyon Zeh. You can't be lenient in this matter of partnerships with a goy and how you're going to handle the Shabbos problem. Kolkach, so much. Ki im b'shas hadchak. If it's really, really an emergency, I mean, this is your panosa, and there's no other way, then you can rely upon certain things. But he says, v'gam oz. But even if you do that, yireh, you should see to it. Sheyiyeh hashtar osui kedin Torah. Make sure the contract between you and the guy is done according to the halacha, according to the laws of the Torah. Al pi horas chacham, and it should be done with the instructions of a chacham, of someone who really knows the halacha, ubepirsum, and you should do it publicly. It shouldn't be a secret that you have a share, and people should know that you went to the Rav, and you have a heter, and you're doing this partnership with this guy. It should be known, it shouldn't be, but you have to do it right. Kemosha kosev ha-Ramo, like the Ramo writes. And then he says the following, And this is what this rabbi told the people who consulted him about doing a partnership. The rabbi said, look, don't go into all the complications of the halacha. Look at these words of the Chofetz Chaim. The Chofetz Chaim writes, V'haboteach b'Hashem, if a person trusts in God, u'mekayem ratzon ha-Torah, and keeps the desire of the Torah. The Torah wants you to keep Shabbos with great risk and great costs and great bother, but that's what the Torah wants. The Laman Yonua, and he's talking about the case where you have a farm in common with a non-Jew. So in the farm, the ox is going to be plowing and the donkey is going to be carrying burdens on Shabbos, and the Jew is not allowed to have his ox or his donkey do those things on Shabbos. And the Torah says, Laman Yonua Shorcho v'chamorecho. It sounds weird to us, but the Torah says your ox should rest and your donkey should rest on Shabbos. You can't do work with them either. So it was a pasuk in the Torah. Kipashtei, and we understand that pasuk literally. V'eino, and so if a person who trusts in God and believes sincerely, simply, but kipashtei, simply, it's Shabbos, I don't want to know from the chochmas. V'eino osei shum tachbulot. Don't do any tricks, any stratagems, even though they're halachically legitimate. L'inyan Shabbos, if you do that, ashrov. Zayge benched, all right? He says, the bracha from the Chofetz Chaim. Ubevadai HaKadosh Baruch Hu yitein lo avur zeh hatzlocha b'nechosov b'sheishis yimei hamasa. Trust in God, he'll see to it that you can make a living Sunday through Friday, 6 days a week. So this people that I know, they came to this Rav and they asked him about this partnership. He said, look, let me show you what the Chofetz Chaim says. You go for brachas, or you'll go for a bracha from this tzaddik and this Rebbe. Here's a bracha from the Chofetz Chaim. Chofetz Chaim puts in writing. Trust in God and do what he wants. Kipashtei, no shtik, no chochmas, and you'll be gebenched. And no question about it, bevadai, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will give you hatzlocha in all your undertakings, b'sheishis yimei hamasa, in the 6 days when you're permitted to work. I keep coming back to it. This is not a Musa Sefer. This is in the middle of his Sefer and Halacha, where he just throws that in. You know, you can learn the past 10 pages and know all the shtick of how it's possible to make these arrangements. Best thing is have a munah and bitochen, and you can make a living without treading on the laws of Shabbos, even in ways that might be legitimate. I thought I'd point that out to you as a practical piece of advice that the Chofetz Chaim gives within the framework of the halacha. An example of faith within the halacha, that was theme B in our list. Theme C is from the introduction to the Mishneh Berurah. The Chofetz Chaim, as I said, many, many works. He's known by the name Chofetz Chaim, which is this work. But certainly in the yeshivish world, and now in the whole entire Jewish world, a halachically observant world, he's also known as the author of a sefer called Mishneh Berurah, which is a compendium, a summary of halachos, a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch Or HaChaim. It comes usually in 6 volumes. Nowadays you can get it in 20 volumes, but the one that I use comes in 6 volumes. And this is from Chelek Aleph. And he writes a preface. You know, why is it so important for him to write another sefer on halacha? It's very interesting to point out, in terms of the history and background of the Chofetz Chaim, how widespread the Mishneh Berurah has become. The Mishneh Berurah was written the past century, in the early 20th century. Not many Sforim written in the early 20th century have become the canon of halacha, C-A-N-O-N, of halacha, like the Mishneh Berurah. But it's prevailed. It has prevailed in the whole area of halacha, the Mishneh Berurah against anyone else. The Chazal Nish writes, we accept upon ourselves the rulings of the Mishneh Berurah as if the author was the Beis Din HaGadol, the Sanhedrin HaGadol. Chofetz Chaim, the Mishneh Berurah, this is the last word on halacha. Although the Chazal Nish himself, who lived into the 1950s, writes in this particular edition that I have in my hands, he writes comments on the Mishneh Berurah and disagrees with him occasionally. But the Chazon Ish had the authority to do that. But in general, we accept almost everything he says as halacha. It's interesting in the relationship between Chassidim and Mitznagdim and all the ugly battles back and forth, which have existed over the centuries and persist to some extent to this day, the Chofetz Chaim was above all that. He was above all that. People, Chassidim, Misnagdim, everyone looks at the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim incorporated within his work the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, the Rav Shulchan Aruch, the Alter Rebbe, the founder of the Chabad movement. Chafetz Chaim quotes him, together with the Vilna Gaon. He makes no distinction between Chassidim, Misnagdim. As long as they, people who knew Halacha, that's what he refers to them. It's interesting that my own observation is, although there was a time within my memory when Chassidim in general wouldn't study the Mishnah Brura so much as they would study the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, the Rav Shulchan Aruch, which was written by the first Lubavitcher Rebbe. Because that's the Chassidish guidebook to Halacha. But that's changed now. And you go to yeshivas, Chassidish yeshivas all over this country and America, Mishnah Brura is the last word in Halacha. But he writes in his Hakdama, this is what I'm calling theme number C, the introduction to the Mishnah Brura, a fascinating, fascinating introduction, in which he writes, what is the importance of Torah? Why is Torah and Halacha so important? So he begins, as he always does, he uses very, very simple analogies. And the analogy he uses here is food to the body. One of our basic beliefs is that we have a body and we have a soul. And the body, we know, has to have food. It has to have food. You can't be Mekayim Onik Shabbos without food. Onik Shabbos is a big mitzvah, but you can dress up in beautiful clothing and you can dance and you can sing, and that's Kavod Shabbos. But Onik Shabbos means a piece of kugel, a roast chicken, and a good cholent. And that's Onik Shabbos. You have to have food. But that's for the body. What about food for the soul? What is food for the soul? So he writes, Lachach, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Berov, this is not in your handouts, no. He writes, Lachach HaKadosh Baruch Hu Berov Chem Loso, God with his great mercy, Nosan Lonu HaTorah HaKadosha Shehu Gam Kein Nitzchis. For the body, you can give food that is not eternal, right? A kugel, it's going to last a couple of days. It's not eternal. But in the neshama, the soul is eternal. So it needs food which is eternal. Food for eternal is what God gave us. And by fulfilling, by eating this food, which is the Torah, Meir Or Hashem Al Nafshenu, God's light shines in our souls. Umei Oso Ha'or, from that light, Anu Misangim, we get pleasure. Shehu Min Tanig Ruchni, we get spiritual pleasure, and that spiritual pleasure is what we live on. And he writes, Gehem Chayenu, this is our life, meaning literally, it is our life, it is our life source, it is our spiritual nourishment. And that's what Torah is all about. So I often use that particular passage in the Hakdama, the preface of the Mishnah Berurah to the first volume, as in defining spirituality. There are many definitions of spirituality, but this is his definition. Spirituality is food for the soul, and food for the soul is Torah. That's food for the soul, literally food for the soul. And he builds on that theme. Let's move on to, we'll skip D for now, and we'll do E, which is tshuva for lashon hara. I don't know if there's anyone here who's guilty of lashon hara, but the truth is that we are all guilty, and it's very interesting to think of the Chafetz Chaim as being a man from a little shtetl, which is nothing. It's a small town in the middle of nowhere. Raden, and the insight that he had to the general culture. So he began writing the Sefer Chafetz Chaim yet in the 19th century, and he saw that there was a sin that's pervasive in the world. He writes that it's pervasive for all humanity, but it's pervasive among the Jewish people too. And that is Lashon Hara, malicious gossip, speaking ill of other people, telling lies, not speaking the truth, everything that's under the rubric of Lashon Hara. And what's fascinating is that if you think of the power and the scope of Lashon Hara today, in the year soon to be Tav Shin Ayin Tes, right? Abo Aleinu L'Tova, you realize the Chafetz Chaim in his wildest dreams couldn't have imagined how bad it's going to get with malicious gossip. He writes about how destructive malicious gossip is in a shtetl in the middle of White Russia, all right? Where if Yankel told Beryl something about a man in Warsaw, it would never reach Warsaw, right? Now, if you say something bad or email something bad about somebody else, it can literally reach the entire human race within seconds. You could ruin a person's, and it happens all the time, you can ruin a person's entire career, entire life, entire reputation in split seconds with the press of a button. And that's the power of Lashon Hara. Chafetz Chaim wouldn't have dreamed of this in a million years. Chafetz Chaim was fascinated in the technology of his time. Now he writes, oh wow, we have a telephone. A telephone that he knew in the 1920s or whenever. Oh, you know what telephone means? As meret du, het mendort. You speak here, and they overhear it over there. Wow. All right, that's a telephone that could reach, you know, in those days, a few miles. Imagine now, as meret du, het mendort. You know, we can use it for good or for bad. Whatever I'm saying now is recorded, but it can be heard now, who knows where. On Tisha B'Av, we had people listening in Amman, and in Cairo, and in Seoul, Korea. Okay, so meret du, in this little room, and meher dorten. So the Chafetz Chaim would really be intrigued by today's electronic communication, social media, etc. So we speak Lashon Hara. How do you do tshuva from it? That is the topic. So if you look on in the page that's labeled with a one in the upper right-hand corner, and you see a page that I reproduced from the Chafetz Chaim, the Sefer called Chafetz Chaim, the laws of Lashon Hara, Klal Tes. And let's just study it together. Suppose you're guilty. You once said something not nice. Remember, it could be true. But you said something not nice about somebody else. You said, I went to this guy one lecture last night. It was terrible. Okay? That's Lashon Hara. All right? It's true. It could be true. And it's, you know, and I might not care. It's probably not true. But that's Lashon Hara. You speak ill of somebody else. So now here it is. It's 2 weeks from tonight, believe it or not, is Yom Kippur. So you spoke Lashon Hara. You want to do tshuva, bo la'asos tshuva. Toli buzze. So it depends upon this. Im hashomim dochu es tevorov. Suppose the people who overheard you, you said, why? I went to this lecture from Warm River, it was no good. And the people say, ach, impossible. Everything he says is gems, pearls. All right. Hashomim, to the listener, rejects what you're saying. Don't tell me that, you know. Even though, so if that's the case, and number two, velonis gana chaveiro al yadeze, the person, the object of your Lashon Hara doesn't care, he's not embarrassed, he's not ashamed, you know, I could live with it. All right, klal beinehem, imkein lo nishar alav, so then you have nothing to, no apologies to make. I don't care. People didn't hear you, didn't accept it. So it's only a sin to God, because even if I don't care, I'm the object of your Lashon Hara. And the people who you spoke to just brush it off. Nevertheless, you have a sin between you and God. It's a sin between you and God. God said, don't speak ill of another person, even if the other person doesn't give a damn. As I said in my introduction. So you have a problem with you and God, your relationship with God. But that you can fix. Tikuno, she is charet al she'ovar. You should have remorse, regret for what you did. I'm really sorry. You should say to God. V'yisvada, and you should confess. God, Ribono Shel Olam, Ashamnu, Baganu, right? I lied. I said Lashon Hara. V'yikabel al atzmo, b'leiv sholem al habo. And should you really commit, make a commitment, honestly, to yourself? I'm not going to do that again. Shlo la'asos kein. K'mo b'chol avon lo she'olam l'mokom. That's true of any sin between you and God. You ate something which wasn't kosher. You don't got to go apologize to anybody. You take it up directly with God. You don't need father confessor. You go to the Father in heaven and tell him, I'm sorry, I'll never do it again, etc. Suppose a person was embarrassed. These people, you know, they're looking to find out, maybe they want to hire one Rebbe as a lecturer, and you went and told him that he's no good. right? So you embarrassed him and perhaps possibly ruined him, ruined his parnosa, whatever. V'nispa v'yadezeh hezek begufo. You know, I can get an ulcer. You know, people talking about me negatively. Oba mamono. You know, I won't be asked to lecture again. And some way you pained me by talking to others about me. Then harehu kachol avono shemadon lachaveru. It's like all other sins between one man, one person, and another. And when it's a sin that you sinned against another person, Yom Kippur is not going to help you. Shafilu Yom HaKippurim is not going to help you. Not only that, but even your death is not going to help you. Yom HaMisa ain mechaper. Certain sins, you're not forgiven, but when you die, you're forgiven. You come before the throne, the holy throne, you'll be forgiven. But not for this one, not if you embarrass somebody. Unless, Achi Ratzes es chaveru, you have to go and apologize to the guy. You have to ask forgiveness to the person that you spoke ill of. When he becomes appeased, when he says, okay, forget about it, no problem, let's go on. Then you still got to take it up with God. You have to go, confess to God, ask God for forgiveness, promise not to do it again, etc. But you... You've done what you had to do with the person that you spoke ill about. Now he says something which is very controversial. I'd like to hear what you think about it. Suppose you spoke to whomever, you spoke ill about me, all right? And I don't know about it. You know you spoke ill about me, and you know there are people out there who believe what you said about me, but I don't know it. I'm a busy man, I got other things to do, I didn't hear about it, I don't know about it. But now you're stuck. The only way you can get out of this sin is by coming to me and telling me, you know, I once spoke bad about you. So I'm going to say, what? In other words, by apologizing to me, you might be making it worse. Right? What are you supposed to do? The Chafetz Chaim says something very interesting. You spoke ill about me, and I don't even know that you did this. Sorech legalos, masha osa negdo shelo kadin. You got to come over to me and say to me, I'm sorry. 3 weeks ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, I spoke ill about you. I heard a drasha gave him shul 25 years ago. I told everybody it was terrible. You got to come and tell me that. I have to have a long line now. People coming telling me that. But you got, and I don't know. I think everybody thought it was wonderful. But no, you're going to tell me this. So you got to ask me for mechila. Because you know, you know that you caused me embarrassment. You spoke negatively about me, so you got to go and tell me that. Now it's very interesting. I don't know where this is written in a primary document, in a primary source, but I've seen it quoted by many people who know about these kinds of things. If you look, the Chafetz Chaim had haskamos, letters of approval from his sforim, from all the great gedolim of his time, who was senior to him. He was a young man, he wrote some of these sforim, relatively young man. But he went around to the Netziv, to the Rav Yitzchok HaChanan, to all the great gedolei Yisrael of that time who were his seniors. But there's one outstanding omission. There's no haskama to his sefer, from my knowledge, from Yisrael Salanta. Rabbi Yisrael Salanta would not, it seems, and maybe he was never asked, etc., but the story is told that Yisrael Salanta refused to endorse his sefer because of this statement. Rabbi Yisrael Salanta said, because you need mechila, you're going to go and make the other guy feel bad? No, don't tell him. You're going to be stuck without doing mechila? That's your problem. But if asking for mechila is going to cause another person humiliation, you can't do that. So we have this fascinating machlokas between Rabbi Yisrael Salanta, who was the focus of his whole life, was musar, was ethics, was proper behavior. So he was so concerned, he felt if asking a person for mechila and the person doesn't know that you offended him, you're going to cause that person offense. So don't ask for mechila. Be stuck with it. Bring it up with the Ribbono Shel Olam, etc. It's very interesting. This is an interesting debate. However, I have a kasha on this Chafetz Chaim, this passage that we just read to you, and it's to be found on page 4. Page 4 is a reproduction of the Sefer Mishneh Berurah. Well, maybe it's on page 3. Let me find it. It's interesting, I can't find it at this moment, but there's a comment that he makes on one of these two pages where he says that you should not apologize to a person who does not know that you offended him if it's going to embarrass him. And I found that to be a contradiction between what we just read, where he says clearly that you should. And I brought this up once with Rav Pam, Zichron Livrocha. I had some contacts with Rav Pam at a certain time in my life, and I used to consult him about my role as a psychologist, and I often was asked about people for shidduchim or for business, and these people were my clients, and I had a professional responsibility to keep their confidentiality and not to speak about them. And sometimes these people would tell others, oh, you want a reference about me? Ask Dr. Weiner. And then people would come to me and they would say, I have this person's permission for you to tell me about him. And so I had a connection with Rav Pam because of another important course that we worked together on, domestic violence. And Rav Pam was an expert on all the works of the Chafetz Chaim. And I asked him this question. And he said to me that the following distinction he made. If by telling this person you're going to cause misunderstanding, etc., then you shouldn't tell him. Then you can tell him, and you should tell him. That's what he said in Chofetz Chaim. But if it's going to cause him humiliation, not just misunderstanding, if I'm using the words misunderstanding versus humiliation, he made that distinction. If I tell you something and you're going to say, oh, so you're not my friend anymore, all right, you got to tell him anyway. Misunderstanding, you won't be friends anymore. But if what you're going to tell him is going to embarrass him, oh, people are speaking about me, I feel like a jerk, I feel ashamed, then don't tell him. So perhaps that's not a machlokas, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter and the Chofetz Chaim, but it depends. But in the passage that we read together, you see how far it goes, even if the person doesn't know about it. I thought what I would do, before we conclude, since it's this time of year, is to share with you a prayer that's composed by the Chofetz Chaim, all right? Chofetz Chaim practiced what he preached. I told you earlier tonight, he advocated writing, composing personal prayers. So here's a personal prayer written by the Chofetz Chaim on page 1, Tefillah al Hadibur v'Hashmiya, a prayer about speech and overhearing improper speech. This is taken from a longer prayer which the Chofetz Chaim himself composed. And here's the prayer. Ribono shel Olam, Master of the Universe, Yehi Ratzon Milfonecha, may it be your wish, Keil Rachum V'Chanun, merciful, compassionate God, Shetezakeni Hayom U'V'Chol Yom, that you should enable me today and every day Lishmor pi ulishoni miloshon hora urechilus, to spare me, my mouth and my tongue, from malicious gossip and rechilus. Rechilus is gossip, whether it's malicious or not. If I go and talk about you because of whatever, that's also rechilus, even if it's not malicious. just bearing, tail bearing is the usual translation of rechilas. So spare me from this. Here too, there's the fact that he would write such a prayer. It's not certainly the first such prayer in the history of Jewish people, because we pray every day, etc. But I never forget another group of college students that I once spoke to were very upset about how we can pray to God to help us not sin. They felt that it was a theological problem. We are supposed to have free will. So what does it mean, God, help me not sin? You're praying to God to take away your free will. Right now, I am free to either right now, in front of all of you, on the microphone, with the cameras going, to speak maliciously about somebody else. That's my bechira, that's my free will. If I pray to God to take away my ability to help me not sin, that's depriving me of my free will. I've heard this question often, especially from sophomores, a sophomoric question, but it's a question. And yet we often pray, God, help me not sin, right? Tatzileini, Meshigios, etc., save me from sin. Chofetz Chaim here is phrasing, and you see it gets more. It gets specific. But I don't think it's a contradiction. I try to explain this to people. Yes, we have free will, but in our struggles, we all have struggles and conflicts, and it's not always easy to control ourselves. So we ask God, you know, help me do the right thing. You know, enlighten me, teach me, and help me with my temper, and help me with my lack of self-control, and help me with all my other faults. That's not taking away free will. That's engaging God in the process of exerting your free will. That's how I look at it. And certainly that was the Chafetz Chaim's doing, and he continues and says, it's Zoher, Miladaber Afilu Ishochet. I want to be careful never to speak even about a single individual. And I'm not speaking about a whole bunch of people. Sometimes we get carried away and we say, that group of people, those so-and-so people, there, blah, 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 blah. That's fish, but I don't want to even speak bad about one person. For Kol Shekein Al Klal Yisroel, I don't want to say Jews are stingy, right? The Jews of certain sorts of shtetl are whatever. And you're speaking about Klal Yisrael. You can't speak negatively about Klal Yisrael. I hate to say it, but you go on YouTube right now, you will see on quote, holy websites, very holy websites, where people speak negatively about other groups of Jews and sometimes about the whole Jewish people. Those Israelis, those Litvaks, those Hungarians, whatever. That's Klal Yisrael. Aval chelek mehem, or some portion of Klal Yisrael. The kol shekein mila hisraim al midosha shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Here he throws in a real interesting theological corker. You shouldn't speak Lashon Hara about God. All right? You shouldn't complain al midos of shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We often say it, God, you're not fair. Right? We believe God is a kel rachum v'chanun. Sometimes it's hard to accept that, you know, because we all experience tragedies, misfortunes, tzoros. No one has ever escaped that. So sometimes we complain about God at the Chafetz Chaim's level. I don't know if we're all capable of this, but the Chafetz Chaim level is a kol shekein. I can't speak bad about Shlaima, and I can't speak bad about Sura, so I certainly can't speak bad about God. Kol Shekein, certainly Mila Hisroi. Mila Hisroi means to thunder, to berail God. For, oh God, how can you do this to the Jewish people? More so, Ve'ezoheim L'daba Divrei Sheker. God, help me not speak things which are false. Chofetz Chaim gives many examples. Don't think things which are false are, did you steal this? Oh, I didn't steal it. Of course that's false. False means you embellish a story, you know, you flatter somebody in a way that's not legitimate, not true. Chanufa. Chanufa is flattery. There are occasions when this is permissible. You know what the Gemara says? You know, you can go over to the ugliest bride in the world and tell everybody she's a kala no'ova chasuda. This girl is beautiful and it's great midos. You know that she's a cheat and a liar and she's ugly as sin. Nevertheless, you can lie, all right? But there are exceptions to the rule. But generally, you're not supposed to speak sheker or chanufa. Machlokes, to get into arguments with people. Kaas, anger, gava, arrogance. Onoas dvorim, you know, onoas dvorim is, you know, Mark gives many examples. One example of a Noah's Dvarim is you go over to a ger, or nowadays you go over to a, quote, Baal Tshuva, a person who's called a Baal Tshuva in today's language, and you tell him, hey, what does lobster really taste like? I always wondered. You know, want to tell me about it? That's a Noah's Dvarim. Here's a guy did Tshuva, a girl did Tshuva, whatever, and you're reminding them about the past that they want to forget about. That's a Noah's Dvarim. That's torturing another person verbally, verbal abuse. Habonas ponim, embarrassing someone, leitzonus, which Rav Huttner used to translate as cynicism, v'chol dibur osa. God, I want to be careful about all these things. It's a long list, but, you know, 2 weeks before Yom Kippur, if not now, when? V'zakeni, and help me, empower me, give me the privilege, shelo ledaber ki im dover hatzorach le'inyone gufi v'nafshi. Now, my speech be limited to those things which are necessary for my body. You go into a grocery store and say, give me a dozen eggs. That's perfectly permissible. All right? V'nafshi, and for my soul, you want to speak divrei Torah. You speak divrei Torah, you have to argue, you have to ask, you have to, etc. That's all legitimate. V'yihiyu kol ma'asai l'shem shamayim. May all my deeds be for the sake of heaven. It's a tall order, but again, if not now, when? It's almost before Yom Kippur. Let's take a quick look at page 2. And we'll conclude with this. We won't look at the whole page, but I'll summarize it for you. In my opinion, in my teaching experience, if you want to teach people about Lashon Hara, against Lashon Hara, the best of the author's works to begin with is not the book called Chofetz Chaim, but it's the book called Shmirat HaLashon, Shmirat HaLashon, which this quote is taken from. This particular book has both of them, Chofetz Chaim, one book, and Shmiras HaLashon, another book. Shmiras HaLashon is less detailed and more emotional, more impactful in my teaching experience. So he tells an interesting thing. I'll be very brief about the first few paragraphs. When the Yom Kippur, the Kohen Gadol goes into the Kodshei Kodashim. No one is ever allowed to go into the Kodshei Kodashim, the Holy of Holies, which you can go near it nowadays, Baruch Hashem, but you can't go in it. And you can go through various tunnels, which are right opposite it. And that's the Holy of Holies. No one ever is allowed to go into it except the Kohen Gadol. And even he can only go into it once a year, and that's in Yom Kippur. When he goes in, he goes through a whole procedure. The whole procedure, we say it in the davening on Yom Kippur. It's a long thing. It's 5 or 6 pages in the Machsa. He does this, and he does that, he does this, and that. But what's the first thing he does? The first thing he does is sprinkle a little bit of incense, of ketores. Now, what's ketores all about? What's the symbolism of ketores? Ketores is usually translated as frankincense. If you ever saw ketores, it looks like little crystal cubes. And it doesn't have a fragrance if you smell it, but if you drop it into a fire, the smoke gives off a very delightful fragrance. That's ketores. And that's the first thing. So the Gemara says that ketores is a kapora, brings about forgiveness for the sin of Lashon Hara. Everything the Kohen Gadol does in the Kodesh Kadoshim on Yom Kippur is to bring forgiveness for another sin. The whole list of sins, we say Al-Chet, it's 2 times the Aleph Beis, that's 44 sins. But the first thing he does is Ketores, and Ketores is a Kapora, forgiveness for Lashon Hara. So now look down to the third paragraph on page 2. V'hisbonein od achi, he speaks to us personally. He says, reflect, my brother or sister. Sha'af sha'pamach as bashon nehutul kohen gadol l'knos l'flav l'fnim. The Kohen Gadol is only allowed to go in there once. And he can only go in there by sprinkling the ketores, with the cloud of ketores, the smoke of the ketores, kimanan ha'ketores. And the purpose is l'hasir avon lashon hara, to get rid of the sin of lashon hara. If he doesn't do that, there's all kinds of terrible consequences, etc. But the first thing he's got to do is get forgiveness for Lashon Hara. He's got a whole day's work, the Kohen Gadol. He's got to ask for forgiveness for his own sins, for his family's sins, for all the Kohanim sins, and all the Jewish people's sins. A lot of work to do, but the first thing he's got to do is get Lashon Hara off the list. Get forgiveness for that. So with last paragraph is, to me, so inspiring. Gam nuchal kulonu lilmod mizeh hanhaga yeshora. So we all should learn from this a very important conduct. Shebavo ha'odom l'sakenis in yonav. When the person comes now a few days before Yom Kippur, And he wants, or she wants, to repair his various inyonim, his various matters. V'lashuv b'tshuva l'vnei Hashem al chatosav. He wants to do tshuva. So he asked the question, I did so many things wrong this year. What am I going to start with? Where do I start? Here's the answer. You start with the sin of Lashon Hara. Techilas hakol, the beginning of it all. Tzorech liros esakein davazeh. You got to do something about your tendencies to speak things you shouldn't be saying. V'hainu chet haloshon, sins of speech. V'yoz teku bal tshuvoso. Take that off the list, and then everything else falls into place. K'moshe matzinu eisla kohen gadol, just like the kohen gadol himself. Shekodem bo l'chaper avon tumas mikdash v'kodshav. Before he approached all the other sins he had to ask forgiveness for, that sins against the Beis HaMikdash and sin against the Karbonos, etc. Mikom okom tzivso ha-Torah oso, the Torah says, Mr. Kohen Gadol, first thing is l'chaper chet ha-loshon ha-dei ha-ktoris. First is the ketoris. So we don't have a ketoris nowadays, but we certainly have the power to control ourselves better, to improve our speech, our interactions with other people. And that's the beginning of tshuva, and the rest kind of falls into place naturally. I want to close by wishing each of you a kesiva v'chasima tova, and a ben shtior, a year of refuah, of health, and panosa, and shalom al Yisrael, and the geula shleima b'mehirah v'yameinu.